All right, so you guys seen a lot of this stuff. This is a talk I just gave a couple of weeks ago at a different place. But anyway, so you know about CMB. If you don't know about CMB, just ask me right now. So, you know, isotropy, dipole, fluctuations. So it's pretty cool. So the COBE map, looking at a part of the COBE map. So that now you get these experiments like boomerang that go around, make circles around the South Pole. All right, so I'm not going to show that. That was supposed to be a movie, but it's not going to work. So anyway, here's the power spectrum from COBE and boomerang. So you guys know all this stuff, right? You can see power at the first acoustic peak and sort of like this, some data a couple of, maybe like 3 or 4 months ago. We all know why you want to do this stuff because, you know, some people have written these amazing codes like CMB Fast, and at the end of the day, anybody can write a paper. That's what cosmology is all about now, writing papers about omega matter and omega lambda. So anyway, so this is the state of the art. This is actually probably about a week old. This is the red data points, comes from this experiment called Archeops. That's a balloon bone experiment. And they have the same detectors as what's going to fly in Planck. So Archeops was essentially a idea was to do a sort of like a pre-Planck type thing to show that Planck will work. But it's pretty amazing, right? I mean, you get this whole acoustic peak, and the Archeops even managed to sort of bridge the gap between the large sort of scales that COBE looked at, sort of the scales that experiments like Boomerang and Maximo was looking at. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
And very colorful.
Very colorful. I mean, it's so amazing. I don't want to go into it, but it's too amazing. I'll leave it at that.
So
Archeops
has better calibration than the others?
Yeah.
Don't
ask me.
Because they go to
the largest. Yeah, so they do cover large areas. That's right. Yeah, so they can probably, they can calibrate on the dipole.
Actually, this plot, I think it's the second plot where they do the best fit calibrations from each experiment. But there is, if you look at them raw, you see a bit more scattering.
Okay, yeah. So you know the usual stuff, right? So because there's acoustic peak here, blah, 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 universe is flat, omega curvature is zero, and all of that stuff. All right, so there's a dark energy. But anyway, the things that people don't talk about is, well, some people talk about it. You know, where am I going? So you're supposed to see this acoustic peak structure, right? You're supposed to see this, you know, acoustic peak. Some people say they see the second peak, third peak. I cannot actually see it yet, but so if you see them, you know, if it is true, I mean, I think it is true that you know, that is telling a lot about like the inflation. This is where the talk is actually heading, that to get out this acoustic peak structure harmonic oscillations, your initial fluctuations has to come up from a very rapid, I mean, there has to be coherence. So inflation can do it, like things like defects and, you know, alternative possibilities really cannot produce these multiple peaks. They essentially produce one big peak, okay? So anyway, this is what's been promised around 2007. So this is Planck, here's the temperature. I mean, this is gonna be amazing, right? Get this estimate of the power spectrum at each multiple to some ridiculous accuracy. Anyway, so the talk is heading towards this, which is, so it comes with even arrows and labels. So gravitational waves, gravitational lensing, so I talk about that. So these are the polarization power spectrum. These are the so-called B modes. Okay. So, yeah, next generation CMB. All right. So the idea is this, right? So we want to do a lot of things. So here's a timeline, a cosmic timeline. We're out here somewhere, and everything we know about the universe is somewhere out here. So this in terms of like an energy scale. So the CMB we are looking at. It's a decoupling era out here. And people who do BBN, you know, at the level of MeVs, looking at the near-clear synthesis. So, you know, there is something that happened, you know, for us to have this, you know, harmonic oscillations and things like that, structure formation. So we have this, you know, the flatness in the universe and whatnot. Yes, you know, apparently at some part early on, you know, we had this the magic thing called inflation. We would really like to figure out where exactly that happened, okay, whether it happened during the gut scales or whether it happened during the supersymmetric scales. Okay? So the reason why, okay, so let's go back. So this is what Robert was saying just now, you know, this, the prediction of this, this sort of this inflation is that you get a background of stochastic gravitational waves, okay? So that's why these CMB experiments are so excited about it, because they want to actually measure this, you know, try to detect these gravitational waves with their CMB experiments. So here you go, the Scientific American article. So this is the idea. Anyway. So let me talk about how to go after this. So the way you want to go after is polarization, and there are some problems while trying to go after it, so I'll describe them. What are the problems that you have to deal with? So if you ask a radio astronomer, right, if you want to measure polarization on the sky, they will talk about Stokes QNU. But in CMB, the Stokes QNU, these are coordinate dependent quantities, which are not very useful in the all sky map cases like CMB. So people have come up with this idea about breaking up the spin 2 field. Polarization is a two-dimensional thing into these so-called E modes and B modes. So the idea is this: take the two-dimensional quantity, you create something which is a gradient of a scale, create something which is a curl of a pseudoscale. Same thing like the electric field and the magnetic field. So that's why these E and B names are coming from. Some people call it the grad modes and the curl modes. But the idea that people realize is that these gravity waves, which are tensor perturbations, right, they contribute to both grad modes and B modes. But scalar, these are the dominant density fluctuations, they don't contribute to these curl modes. Okay? Because these B modes, you can't distinguish between the left and the right handed waves, and density fluctuations don't have that. So polarization in the grad case is essentially the way you generate polarization in CMB is through rescattering. Okay? So scattering happens, you know, you have essentially the quadrupole that gets scattered. So for example, in the case like when the universe gets reionized at low redshifts, the temperature quadrupole can get rescattered again, right? That generates a polarization. So this big thing that a lot of people are trying to measure these days with their large angular scale experiments, which is to measure the redshift of the reionization, okay? But going back, so this is that plot actually I'm showing you. So the color scale here is actually the temperature quadrupole. So here's the temperature quadrupole that was generated at the last scattering surface from excess, like the Sachs-Wolfe effect. And at low redshift, you know, it gets scattered, and the polarization pattern, you know, traces the underlying temperature quadrupole pattern. Now, people have been trying to detect these things back since 1964, since the early days of Penzias and Wilson. So the limits are coming down. So this used to be the state of the art. This is the Brian Keating's. There's an experiment based at Wisconsin. But this whole thing changed about 3 months, well, last month, I guess, with the DAISY. So DAISY detected essentially the phi sigma detection of polarization, essentially two bins, okay? So the problem with the DAISY is that, you know, they cover only limited sky. So they're restricted to like large multiples. They can never probe this region out here, which is very interesting for essentially, you know, structure formation side and, you know, galaxy formation side, because you really want to know where the reionization happened. And this is sort of what, you know, MAP can say. And the rumor is that MAP will actually say something about it. Okay. So I showed you this. Anyway, so going to gravitational waves, right? So if you want to detect gravitational waves, they have a distinct signature.
Could you explain in one word how the polarization measurements are done? You actually have a filter for polarization?
Oh, yeah. So actually, that means I might have a thing about an experiment that's trying to do this. Okay, so I'll show you, describe this.
Technology, what is the idea? You just have just a linear polarizer?
Yeah, you just have a linear polarizer, and then you want to measure two components of polarization.
Okay.
45 degrees, one.
You just rotate your polarizer.
Right, yeah. So going back here. So you want to detect the gravitational wave background, right? So remember, the gravitational wave background contributes to all of the stuff, like the temperature, the E modes. But the problem there is, like in the case of temperature, the density fluctuations, the scalar fluctuations, dominate over the tensor fluctuations. So you can never separate them out. The good thing is that why all these people are excited is that the only signature in the B modes, okay, is due to, you know, is due to gravitational wave. Well, other than foregrounds and confusions, in the primordial sense, the only signature in the B modes is due to gravitational waves. So that's why they want to detect. So anyway, here's a map. The thing that, I don't know if you can get out of this plot here. So you see these hot spots and the cold spots. The polarization tend to peak actually away from, when it comes to gravitational waves, the polarization actually peaks away from where the temperature is highest. Okay, so like in these regions, it's where you actually expect most of the polarization to happen. But there is a big problem. Otherwise, I wouldn't be giving this talk, which is I'll explain this later on. If you, in the B modes, I said you only expect gravitational waves. That's actually a confusion effect, which is due to gravitational lensing. Okay, so remember in that Planck plot I showed you, there were two things labeled with arrows: gravitational waves and gravitational lensing. It's the same thing. So I'll come and explain what this is, but I just want to show you. The Daisy results on the same B modes. Remember, Daisy measured the polarization. They only made a big deal about E modes, but they also measured the B modes. And they also have a 1 to 2 sigma detection. They never made a big deal about it because I don't know why. But anyway.
But the banded E mode detection was only a couple of sigma. It's only when they take the shape into account that they get it.
Right. That's right.
So what happens if they take a
shape? I have no idea, actually.
It must be a pretty
I don't know, actually. But I asked them, actually, why do you not emphasize the B modes in your paper? And they said they are not sure about their system. I mean, the thing is, you know, there are problems when you do this EB decomposition, stuff like that. So, all right, so a lot of people are trying to go after these B modes, right? So at Caltech, there's a new experiment called BICEP. And I'm not going to say much about it because let's see, Keating is going to be here next week, and he'll give a talk on Thursday. So he'll describe this experiment to you. But anyway, so the idea is BICEP was an experiment that's going to target this region out here in multiple space. So it has two purposes. One purpose is to go after this reionization peak in the E modes. The second purpose is to go after the B mode signature at the same time. So I'm not going to describe this, but this is an amazing experiment. And it's been proposed to go to the South Pole, so it's a huge, it's something like 100, essentially, radiometers in the focal plane, just looking at the sky. So it's not really like a big telescope, because you are not looking at fine angular scales, you are looking at very large scales, degree scales. So you just have like a big, this whole thing is just your telescope, basically. That's going to sit on the South Pole, tilted away by 15 degrees, and then going to make circles. Okay. All right, so this is what sort of the calculation came out to be in terms of detection of this peak due to reionization in the grad mode. This assuming that the reionization happened at like redshift of 20, which may be too high. And this is the detection they will get in terms of gravitational waves, but I come back to this because this is a big assumption here. We have no idea how to put the amplitude of this gravitational wave thing. Okay? So the lensing signature comes. Let me just briefly describe. So what we are doing is we are looking at the last scattering surface, right? We are collecting photons on the way to us. And the usual assumption is that nothing happens to those photons coming to us from the last scattering surface after decoupling. But the universe is a complex thing between us and the last scattering surface. So you get effects like, when the universe gets reionized, you get free electrons. That means photons can scatter again. These are the effects like Sanyo-Seldovich effect, right? Scattering of CMB photons. We have free electrons. So one of the effects is also the gravitational lensing. So if the structure forms and you have mass clumps in the universe, like galaxy clusters, right? So the photon paths are perturbed. So instead of looking at one direction, say, you get some contribution coming from a slightly offsetted direction, which is being, moved into your path by the gravitational lensing effect. Okay. So you can calculate this in terms of like temperature, right? You're essentially doing a mapping of temperature on the last scattering surface, right? So you can do it in a perturbative sense in terms of sort of the deflection angle associated with lensing. So the deflection angle associated with lensing is essentially the integral of all the you know, line of sight integrals of all the gradients of the potentials between us and the last scattering surface. So people know this stuff anyway, it's nothing new. So if you look at the temperature map, so this is the sort of the primary modal anisotropy power spectrum for temperature. So gravitational lensing effect is essentially moving power from like the place, the peaks in temperature, and dampening on to sort of the damping scales. So the power shows up here from here. So there's a transfer of power from large scale to small scales. And these are the scales where you have clustering of mass, like galaxy clusters and stuff like that. So that's why the power shows up here. Okay. So the blue lines here are essentially scattering effects I told you about, having free electrons like the SC, the Doppler effect, and whatnot. Red lines are due to gravity. So there's another effect which everybody knows. That's the integrated Sackse-Wulff effect. That's the essentially the evolving potential.
So all these effects lead to some smearing out of the
right.
Of these plots, but they don't produce polarization or anything.
No, so I'll come back to it. Yeah, there is a effect that produce polarization. So for if you look at this plot, which is what people have been doing, is essentially looking at this, right? The acoustic peaks. None of these contributions matter, right? Because these are very small for all practical purposes. Like recently there was this experiment, CBI, which actually managed to go down to these scales, and then they detected some excess out here. Instead of going all the way down here, CBI detected some like 1 to 2 sigma excess power. So now people interpret that as the SC effect. And we had that discussion, right, with Martin, when Martin was here, about the sigma 8 and all that stuff because of that. So going on to, okay, so I talked about this. But anyway, going on to polarization. So here are the E modes. This is the reionization signature, right? So these are the B modes. So what happens is in the same way, right, there's a transfer of power in the temperature that goes from large scale to small scales. In the case of polarization, you have some transfer of power. But one of the things that happens is that some of the power in E modes also shows up in the B modes. There's a conversion from E-like type polarization to B-like type polarization from gravitational lensing. And that's actually a big problem because you're only transferring like few percent power, right? This is a 1% effect, even less than a 1% effect. Right, and that actually, the same way, power gets transferred. But the problem is it shows up in the B mode map. That's really a problem, especially if your gravitational waves are very small, right? So then there are also other confusions way down here. Just like due to scattering, here are polarization that get created by electrons in galaxy clusters. There are effects like Sanyo-Seldovich effect that happens in polarization too. So these are these two lines. That's not the real problem. The real problem is out here. In gravitational lensing.
Why is it only on small scale? Why can't you lens the reionization hump in the E modes?
You can do that too. But the reionization hump in the E mode happens at like ratio of 10 maybe, right?
Okay.
So the path length is very small. Lensing is not very big effect. I'll show you later on a plot which shows that most of the lensing happens because you have a huge path length all the way out to the last scattering surface.
Is the lensing is coming from galaxies, or what sort of scales
is coming from galaxy cluster scales.
Right. So
yeah.
Then, at the small reionization, it's probably too large scale to be.
Right. I mean, yeah.
Because of a 10% effect would be enough to wipe out the beam of style, just looking at the order of magnitude.
Right. Well, I mean, it depends on where it shows up, right? So this power will end up showing up around here. So these are the peak here is essentially is a reflection of the angular scale of stuff that's doing lensing. So the power that will get transferred and eventually show up at the scales of where things, stuff that's doing lensing. All right. So the same thing, gravitational waves. So this is actually the problem, right? So I've been showing you this curve for gravitational wave all this time. But that curve assumes something about where to put these gravitational waves, something about the inflaton potential, the energy scale of inflation, right? So what I've been doing is essentially putting it at sort of like a limit implied by the Kobe data, right? If you assume that all of the fluctuations in Kobe due to tensors, gravitational waves, that gives you the upper limit of
the... Do I understand the problem? The problem is that this rescattering by lensing can fake gravitational wave effects? Or what's the
The problem is this. Problem is we don't know what the amplitude of this gravitational wave contribution is. We don't know when the inflation happened, right? The amplitude of this curve, the gravitational wave curve, depends on the energy scale of inflation.
This is the amplitude of one of the modes that we're
on. I can't see your hands. Oh, sorry. So this curve, I'm saying, the overall amplitude of this curve. I have to put it at some amplitude, right? I have a huge big freedom here, which is the overall normalization.
This would be primordial. And then the problem is that the lensing effects may fake this or
no, lensing effect may wash it out, right? If it goes below out here, if this thing goes below here, we will never detect it, right? Because there's a dominant thing out here. So I think I passed over a slide, but the point was that the amplitude where I put this curve, right, which is the inflaton energy scale, I mean the energy scale of inflation or something, it actually goes as the square of the energy scale, okay? The amplitude of gravitational waves background, the stochastic background. Here in this problem actually, because I'm looking at the power spectrum, it's actually square of the amplitude, so it actually goes as like the fourth power of the energy scale of inflation. So you can make a very small change in the energy scale of inflation, like factor of 2. And you will get this change by large amount, by like factor of 2 to the power 4. Anyway, so, you know, if I go down by a very small amount, this will go down like extremely, you know, very low. And then we will never see this because we will get washed out by this curve. So this curve is fixed.
This curve is the mixing up effect due to the lensing.
Yeah, this curve is the lensing. This curve is fixed. There's no... When I fix my cosmological parameters like omega matter and stuff like that, this curve becomes fixed. There's no freedom to move it up and down anymore. But there's a huge big freedom here because there's a one unknown parameter here which is not fixed by current cosmological models like omega matter and omega lambda. So this curve, you know, it can go huge way down. So it becomes a huge big problem for people trying to detect this thing. Right? I mean, what you measure at the... But in your experiment, right, even though I'm drawing two curves here, in your experiment, what you measure is the sum of these two, right? You will have no idea how to break it up. I mean, that's the problem.
Can you remind me, why does the amplitude
below
the energy scale of inflation square?
Bob can.
Can I do it later? just H over M Planck squared.
Yeah, it just, yeah.
The amplitude is H squared?
Yes.
Oh, the amplitude is H,
but then... In the CL plot, it becomes squared.
Ah.
All right, so anyway, so...
So basically the statement is, for energy scale below 1 times 10 to the 16, you'd never be able to see the gravitational waves move.
Well, yeah, but I wouldn't be giving this talk if that's the case, because there are ways to separate this. That's the way.
You'd never be able to see them via... polarization effect in the CMB.
Right, but the talk I'm heading is that we figured out a way to separate these two. So I will tell you briefly how we can do that. Okay, anyway. So just these are the noise curves in red here. Essentially, I'm just showing you. People talk about doing a post-Planck type experiment to detect this gravitational wave background. So Planck right now, it's right over here, Planck. 10 times better Planck, you know, would be able to do something like this. 50 times better Planck, you know. But what you're doing is essentially getting some information about the gravitational lensing effect. All right, so the direction that the talk is heading is that essentially I want to tell you how to separate these two things out so that you can actually do better. You know, you can essentially lower this. So the idea is like you want to look at what the lensing is doing in CMB. So here's like essentially a temperature field. Wayne made this when I was a grad student there with him. So Gaussian random field, you know, if you have gravitational lensing, you can clearly see the signatures. It's like, you know, you guys seen the lensing galaxy maps, right? You get these tangential alignments and stuff like that. So you can clearly see this lensing effect in a CMB.
Scale here
is pretty large, yeah. The thing you realize that Riemann showed you sort of the perturbation type expansion, right, in terms of the deflection angle. So the lensing effect shows up as like a second order effect in CMB fluctuations, right? That means if you want to do a lensing reconstruction in your CMB map, you know, you cannot just do it by measuring like angular correlation function, which is the, you know, first order sort of statistic. You have to go higher order than that. Okay? And the other problem is usually CMB maps become noise dominated, which means you have to be smart about when you do higher order statistics in a map, that so that you are not going to be noise dominated. So I'm not going to take you all the things, but I'll show you the new way to think about it, which is if you take your CMB map and you square the CMB map and you take the Fourier transform of it, so that means the square and take Fourier transform, essentially that's a convolution of two CMB maps. And if I go back into my, you know, I showed you a sort of a mapping equation, right, how the lensing is mapped in terms of temperature, you can show that this quantity is essentially proportional to the deflection angle. Okay, so you can show that quadratic statistics allow you to reconstruct the deflection angle, but this is the naive explanation of what's happening. So you can do things like, for example, measure like what's called the trispectrum. That's the Fourier transform of four-point correlation function. But that's really hard thing to measure because the signal to noise there is.
So if I have no lensing, what happens? This quantity is zero?
Or? Yeah, if you have no lensing, this quantity is zero. Well, this quantity has a sort of like a noise part, I mean, a Gaussian part to it, but it is zero if there's no lensing.
Assume Gaussian.
Yeah, we are assuming the fluctuations, the primordial fluctuations in CMB are Gaussian.
Oh, okay. So then if something's in the way, it's obviously
the source of purely Gaussian, right? Right. Yeah, so that's, yeah. Anyway, so here you go.
Well, either you discover something now,
How would you disentangle non-Gaussianity in the initial spectrum?
So you can, instead of measuring the four-point function, you measure the three-point function, right? Mm-hmm. Lensing doesn't show up in the three-point function, okay? And that will be all your primordial non-Gaussianity there. I mean, you know, there are other problems too, but anyway. So what you want to do is essentially, so instead of measuring like individual trispectrum configurations, one of the things you can measure is sort of like a squared power spectrum. That is something like a temperature squared type power spectrum. So there what you're doing is you're keeping your diagonal fixed. Yes, then you are summing up all the modes of all the configurations of the trispectrum. Anyway. Then there are ways to essentially get rid of the noise. There are filtering schemes we derived, which we optimize to do all this extraction of the lensing in the CMB map. So anyway. Think we can handle this, and you know, I had a student from Caltech who's doing a lot of stuff on this. Actually, he's still working with me.
Are you measuring trispectrum for general configuration or for this collapsed configuration?
You're squaring the temperature and then measuring 2.5.
You're squaring the temperature and measuring a 2.5. You're squaring the temperature. You're filtering it. You have a filter that will get rid of all the excess noise. Then we are measuring a power spectrum on the squared map. So let me give you another explanation of what we are doing here. So the what's happening with gravitational lensing, if you have a correlation function, right? And the usual assumption is that the correlation function of this temperature peaks and stuff like that is isotropic. Like if you measure it in one way, it's the same as if you measure it in the other way, things like that. But in presence of lensing, the non-Gaussianity thing, what's happening is that correlation becomes anisotropic. Okay? So another way to explain what we are doing is essentially we're looking for that anisotropy, turning that around and inferring something about gravitational lensing. Okay. So this is not the only way. There are various other ways where people say take gradients in your temperature map, things like that, to do a lensing reconstruction too. So there's a lot of work in this field. So just a comparison of how well you can do. So this is sort of like a mass map. You take this map, put behind it a Gaussian random field, gravitation lens it, observe it, add some noise, then do a reconstruction, which is, you know, then you essentially recover it pretty well. But here we are doing it with a 1.5 arc minute beam, which is way, way better than current experiments and way, way, very low noise. Okay?
So if you use temperature gradients, you still have to consider basically 4.6.
Yeah. 4.6. Yeah. Yeah, so this is actually just a comparison. This is for Planck, actually. So this is the temperature gradient, how well they do in terms of cumulative signal to noise. I just want to show this to Celjack one day. That's like this plot. But anyway, so there's a reason why you want to do this. So remember when Yearly Penn was here, right? He was talking about lensing, galaxy shear, and stuff like that. He was talking about a quantity called convergence, right? So it's the same quantity I'm plotting here. So people do with these galaxy lensing studies. That means they use shapes of galaxies. They, you know, they measure this, and this is what you expect. You know, you'd be able to do. But the blue curve here, the top curve, is actually doing the same thing, the way I described, and measuring that same quantity in a CMB map. Actually, here it's using the Planck data. Okay, so there's a big difference here between redshift 1 and redshift 1,000. That's essentially the amount of mass, excess mass beyond redshift 1 all the way out to redshift 1,000. Right? That's that reason why this amplitude is different. This essentially answers another question, which is people have been asking, if we knew, like if you had did this weak lensing service with galaxies, why not use that information to, you know, do cleaning in your CMB map? But you can already answer that, because you cannot do it because there's so much lensing happening above, like, you know, redshift 102 that people can't do with galaxies. So you really need a source. In other words, you really need a source all the way at the last scattering surface to do a pretty good cleaning of the CMB map to get rid of some of these lensing confusions.
But since most of lensing is done by a nonlinear structure like clusters, if I move the source out to 10, it's already most of it already.
That's right.
I don't have to go to
the yeah, so if you can do your galaxy lensing shear at the redshift of like 10 or 15, yeah, okay, but nobody's doing lensing out that redshift, right? So that's the hard problem. Yeah.
Yeah,
I calculated this. You have to be about 7, actually. We calculated.
Seven.
Yeah.
But to clean it, you wouldn't trust it if you only went to 10. If you were trying to clean up your CMB map, unless, you know, you could show that. I think
you
really could just turn off.
All right. So anyway, this is amazing, right? This is what you can do. You can measure it, you know. People are spending a lot of time building these telescopes and whatnot to measure this quantity, you know, with the galaxy, measuring galaxy shapes, right? That's like the biggest thing nowadays. But you can use a CMB map in one of these upcoming experiments to do the same thing with the huge accuracy too. So there are a couple of reasons why you want to do this in TCMB, apart from this problem with the gravitational waves, just doing this, right? Because you can interpret this very easily. For example, you know recombination. We know that the source we are looking at it, where exactly it is. So if you want to do cosmology out of this, it's a big plus. The problem here always for these people, like, you know, the Yale UN explained some of that stuff, that you don't actually know for the most of the part what the background redshift distribution is for the source galaxies you are looking at. So then the cosmological interpretation is a little bit hard for this. Okay?
That goes both ways, right? That means you don't have
cosmography. Right. You only get one here. You can do many fancy stuff with galaxies. Yeah. But anyway, but the point I wanted to really make is that you get this for free. All right, so this is just to show you the same thing in a different L weighting here, but this is showing how well you can do by going into better experiments with you have more and more better angular resolution. So you go from 5 arc minute sort of experiment all the way down to like 1 arc minute experiment. But essentially, you cannot do very well, like galaxy stuff, right? When you do galaxy lensing, you can go down to very small scales because you can go all the way down to the scales where, you know, you become shot noise limited by the number of galaxies. Here you get cut off by the beam, but you also get cut off by the fact that when you go to small scales, the CMB fluctuations in the background don't have enough power, right? There's a damp intel that cuts off power. So there's no fluctuations in the background to get gravitationally lensed. So that's the reason why when you go like 5-2-1, these things seem to be converging. So beyond like, you know, 1 arc minute or half arc minute beam, you really don't gain much, like going into a much better high angular resolution experiment. All right, so once you do this, you can do all sorts of nifty stuff, like you can correlate with the sun yourself, the Ridge effect, you know, you can do. This is all good for understanding astrophysics. So we were thinking about this for a while, and I was telling this to Roger Blanford, and we sort of came up with an idea, which is that if you take a look at a Hubble deep field type map, right, even in galaxies. You see all these galaxies where people can measure like the shapes, but in the background you get all this like fluctuation stuff. You can never measure the shape in there, but you can treat that background as just like in CMB, we treat it like a fluctuation background. And then you can go there, remove all your bright things, treat your fluctuation, and do a reconstruction of lensing, just like I described in CMB. And you can actually, you know, this is actually the techniques we develop for CMB can also apply to galaxies to some extent. You're averaging over, you know, smoothing it out, your pixels, measuring your correlation functions, looking for anisotropy in the correlation function, do a quadrupole moment on that, you get your estimate for shear. Okay? And it's pretty neat, actually. Turns out that you can go to much smaller scales with that than you can go with galaxy shear data. All right, so now I said, yeah, this was actually the plot, like, so here's the confusion signal. And if I knew my structures, all the other ratio of 1, this is how well I can do. If I knew out ratio of 10, this is how well I can do. Okay. But anyway, so like with CMB, you know, since I know my, now I do the reconstruction, that means I know what's doing the lensing. I can go back and clean my maps. Then I can reduce this confusion. Okay? So I can, instead of having it out here, I can reduce it to like order of magnitude or better. Okay, so the curves here are for like Planck and something better than Planck or something. So what you get out at the end is you can essentially detect this. You know, instead of detecting one thing where you don't know how to separate, you can detect them separately and you can put error bars on the contribution due to gravitational waves. But the problem is some of these error, you know, these errors contain noise due to your separation too. So then the question is how well you can do this. Instead of showing you this, let me show you another plot. So my time scale again here. So I'm going to blow up this region, right? So this region goes from about 10 to the 19 GeV to down to like 10 to the some 12 GeV. So gut scale is about 10 to the 16. That's where most of the people say inflation would have happened. There are a lot of people out there who actually say it's about 10 to the 12 GeV, the supersymmetric scales. Anyway, so that's the range in energy scale. Blue line here is the amount of gravitational waves you expect. So the first thing is we already know an upper limit, right? That's just all the fluctuations in COBE. If you say it's due to tensors, you know, that gives you upper limit, and that comes to about 2 or 3 times 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay? So you can go about a factor of 2 better than that if you want to look for the sort of the change in the sort of the curve, right? When the curve goes about the lensing curve, you know, you can hopefully directly detect the gravitational wave things. But what you can do is you can improve this. So this is where the usual confusion point was before we could do the lensing separation. Now we can push this down. So if you do a lensing cleaning with like a 1 arc minute beam and some noise layer like this, we go down by another order of magnitude. But we are still down like 10 to the 15 GeV type level. And this is sort of the best you can do with no noise, sort of cosmic variance limited type thing. So you can only go down to like 10 to the 15 GeV, and then you hit a stop. I mean, essentially hit a wall there. Because even if you have perfect data, all sky map, you can never, you know, there's a problem, which is like, you know, you have one universe and one reconstruction. So you can never do a perfect separation of the gravitational waves and the gravitational lensing. So this region remains undetectable. You're getting confused with the lensing. So people don't stop there. They write, you know, they write proposals. So if they say if there's a stochastic background of these long wave gravitational waves, don't detect it CMB out here, detect it with a post-LISA type experiment. So there's a thing called GRADE that's already been proposed to NASA. All right, so how much time do I have? Sorry? 15 minutes. All right, 15 minutes. So this was the point about the gravitational waves I want to tell you, which is like all the way down to, you know, we can do a, instead of being stopped out here, we can do a sort of like an order of magnitude improvement on that by just doing a lensing reconstruction. I want to show you, let me go back.
When you say reconstruction, you mean you actually produce a map of that data and actually go back?
Yeah, you actually go back. you actually go back, clean your Qs and Us, I mean, E and B, then measure the power spectrum on that. Okay. All right, so one quick thing I want to show you. This is actually a paper we just wrote recently. It's sort of the best thing I ever done. So the Sanyasa-Lewitt effect, it is true. It's a pretty neat thing, actually. Best thing I've done in the last 6 months, probably. So the Sanyasa-Lewitt effect is, you know, it's a CMB blackbody, right? You're scattering off that in hot electrons. So what you're doing is you're moving in the log frequency, right? So Sanyev actually said, hand drew this for a paper in 1980. Anyway, so here's the blackbody for the CMB and the SC effect. After scattering, like the, you know, the SC decrement that you're looking at has a frequency dependence, looks like this, right? It goes negative, it goes positive, there's a crossover frequency. So people have been doing measurements of this Sanyasa-Lewitt effect, so this is actually a map of that. So what you're looking at, these contours, this is a galaxy cluster, right? And what you're looking at the contours is the temperature decrement, because they are looking at these low frequencies. And the background is the X-ray emission, that's the emission of the thermal branch law, that's NE squared. This thing is just due to NE. Okay, so looking at this spectrum, people have been doing this, you know, multi-frequency data stuff. So here are three measurements of one cluster. This is some Abel cluster. And here is a sort of low frequency point. And people have been doing this sort of this frequency measurements for a long, long time, because there are two effects, actually. One effect is the scattering effect due to the thermal motions in the cluster. That depends on like KTE, the energy of the electrons. There's another one which is like in the rest frame of the CMB, the cluster is moving away or towards you. So there's a Doppler effect, which is this kinetic SC effect. Okay? So people are using this, people have been doing this for a long, long time, talking about this, doing this multi-frequency measurements to separate this kinetic versus thermal so that they can actually measure this velocity of the cluster. Okay? And that's a hard game to do. You people have only got upper limits. So the crazy idea we had was that turns out that if you plot this, when you plot this, people are seeing what the CMB temperature is. Yeah, 2.73 and whatnot. But if you know what the CMB temperature is, just plot it as, you know, assume that you don't know what the CMB temperature is. Plot it as a function of different CMB temperatures. And there's a change in this curve. Okay? And this is the neat thing, which is that the CMB, what depends on here, it turns out that it's not the CMB temperature today. What matters is CMB temperature at the scattering scheme at high redshift. Essentially, that means if you do this multi-frequency measurement, you can infer something about the temperature of CMB at high redshift at the redshift of the cluster. Nobody thought about this. So anyway, so we wrote a paper. I got this Italian group who had this data. So these are the two clusters that we measured the CMB temperature, two data points. This is actually the same cluster I showed you before. And it turns out there are some measurements. People look at this transitions in like cyanide or something, and you know, but they are limited to like ratio of about 2, because that transition depends on when the background temperature is about like 10 Kelvin, right? So then, you know, but it's pretty neat, actually. We can measure the CMB temperature with the Sanyasa-Lewitt effect. And we can actually do better, because with experiments like Planck, which will cover many frequencies, many clusters, all the way at ratio of 1, you can cover this region nicely. And you can test one fundamental thing about cosmology, which is whether the CMB temperature goes like 1 plus ratio or not. Anyway, I thought that was really neat. All right, thanks. That's all I want to say. I don't have doubts, but why not check it if your data allows you to check it?
Sure. So that's done from the crossover frequency, basically?
No, it's looking at, so I showed you the curves, right? There's no crossover frequency, there's
so
a shifting.
You're not using a single point, are
you? No, you're using all these points. I mean, here are the curves, how they're different.
Because the electron temperature.
Right, sure. So we have to worry about these relativistic corrections and whatnot. Yeah, I mean, we talk about it, all of that. There are two papers here. There's a data paper on FJ. There's a paper somewhere that I drafted on theory side. Okay, so we talk about
corrections.
We worry about all that stuff. Yeah, but yeah, so you have to worry about them. But it's pretty, I mean, people have been writing papers about separating this versus that, but ignore the kinetic SC effect. Just measure something very easy to measure. I mean, You can already measure. Look at the error bars that we got already. I mean, you can do a pretty good job. I mean, it's better than these error bars that people get out trying to measure this from cyanide or whatever.
It's not doing sort of cosmology for you. You're not going to get cosmological parameters
from this. No, no. You're measuring the same. But you're testing something very fundamental. That's the beauty of the thing. That's why I said I really like this.
So actually, if people could not do a follow up to find the cluster redshift, would this give you the cluster redshift?
Oh, yeah, I guess. If you assume something, but.
Get the proper motion of the
cluster. I don't want to go that far. it'll give you this. Yeah, if you assume what the CMB temperature is today, standard cosmology, 1 plus redshift, yeah, it'll give the cluster redshift, yeah.
You're right.
Well, you can
measure
proper motions because you have to
the observed shift,
mm-hmm.
redshift, and then
you'll
have this redshift, which won't be consistent.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We didn't go that far.
That's
this is all we wanted to do.
Why is it that the squaring of the temperature method is better than the gradient method?
Okay.
What is the reason?
Yeah. So the reason is very simple. Is that so the squaring method, the gradient method, you know, in Fourier space, you know, it just differed by some kind of a filter, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. But in the squaring method, what we did was we actually came up with the optimal filter.
Presumably, with the gradient, you can also filter it in some other
way. Yeah. So. They never came up with the optimal filter. They just take gradients. Yeah, so the two things are equivalent. So I'm actually trying to go back to show you the filter. But anyway, so that's why. So the squaring method is the most optimal. It's the best you can do. We've shown that. So you never can do better than that. So the filter has like nice things. Essentially, you're picking out your damping tail. Okay, that's where all the power is due to lensing, right? But I showed you there's the acoustic peak structure is going to be changed by a small percent. So that's why this filter has this sort of these fluctuations. The problem is to design this filter. You need to know what the power spectrum of your primordial fluctuations are. So you have to assume that. Right? That means you know all your cosmology or something. So there is sort of like a problem there, which is like you will never know this filter to the accuracy that you want to know.
Does the method depend in some fundamental way that then there is a damping tail that has no structure in the CMB on the response? Does it matter?
So the method will improve if there's structure. So you will gain more information out if there's more fluctuations going into the damping tail. So the method is independent of what that is right now, because you can always reconstruct your filter. But the thing is. If there is actually turns out that there is primary fluctuations at very small scales, the lensing reconstruction becomes more and more better. I mean, you get more and more signals, right?
So these quadratic statistics, they're just first derivatives of the temperature field, or
yeah.
What
so the
order
what order of the derivative? It's not real. Well, it's not. There's no derivative actually. I mean, just taking the temperature map, squaring, but
I thought these things like the convergence were.
Oh, in terms of like a potential, right? So we are reconstructing the deflection angle here, which is a gradient of one derivative.
No, I didn't mean the temperature.
You meant the temperature?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no derivative here.
Is what you get from a first derivative of the temperature.
The correction was.
No, but this is doing it another way.
This is doing it another way. That, so the paper that Seljak wrote, they do get a gradient out there in temperature. There is a derivative in there, but it's you know, we talked about the most general thing here.
So in this using the random background, the deep background, wouldn't the intrinsic homogeneity in the background dominating more significant than the
intrinsic, what do you mean?
Just due to fluctuations in the background.
But that's what we are trying to look at, right? The fluctuations in the background gets gravitationally lensed.
Yeah,
So that's the fluctuations in the background actually helps us here. We actually want more fluctuations to be there. So that they
there's so much fluctuation, how do you know what is due to the background and what is due to the background?
So there is a noise part, right? That's what I said, you had to come up with sort of like a way to get rid of this excess noise. So you had to come up with a filtering scheme to remove all that stuff that you don't want. That's the difference between some of these schemes, why they differ, how well they can get rid of that extra noise due to this, just having huge amount of Gaussian fluctuations.
So to apply this method to the galaxy, as you suggested, I mean, this method relies on the background, the source fluctuation being Gaussian. Of course, when you smooth Gaussian,
yeah,
it's not being Gaussian. So
right.
What are you doing?
Yeah, so that's the so one of the reasons why that paper is not public is trying to deal with some of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is actually a lot of problems to deal with over there.
Can you calculate the bias due to the fact that you assume you know the background perfectly well? I mean, if you put different cosmological models, the CMs will change.
Right.
Is there a bias because of that? Like, can you calculate that easily? Or is that small?
I don't know. Probably small.
What do you mean by bias? Well, I mean, to reconstruct you for this filter, you got to put in the, you know, the unlensed spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But that,
else.
Yeah, but that means you actually know all the parameters perfectly.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
yeah.
I see the errors in the parameters.
Sort of the mismatch you're saying.
Right, so the filter, you can never reconstruct perfectly because you don't know what the fundamental thing before lensing you're looking at, right? So yeah, so there are problems with that.
Have you thought that somebody had
here? Yeah, so Mike estimated all that stuff. Yeah. But well, depends on what you assume about some parameters, but or some things. Like he mentioned, like if there is excess power in the damp tunnel and we don't know that beyond our standard cosmology, then so like, you know, it's either you lose or you win depending on how you treat that.
Or even if you just assume the standard cosmology,
right,
you know, the error bars that
you
have.
Right.
Like really small,
well, for like the Planck time era, it's not. I'm not really worried. I would be worried about it right now.
All right. Let's thank Vasantha again.